University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents David Sorin, Professor of Classical Archaeology at the University of Arizona, speaking on Buried Alive, an Ancient Catastrophe in Cyprus. Sorin led the digging team which discovered a family of well-preserved skeletons on the Mediterranean island of Cyprus last summer. He has also participated in excavations in England, Turkey, Tunisia, and Portugal. In addition to heading the Department of Classics at the University of Arizona, Sorin is the director of the university's exchange program in archaeology with Cyprus and Portugal. He is also a guest lecturer and guest curator of the American Museum of Natural History in New York.
Welcome to Forum this morning. We have as our guest this morning Professor David Sorin, head of the Department of Classics, Classical Archaeology, and Religious Studies at the University of Arizona. Professor Sorin did his studies at Dartmouth and then at Harvard, and has been a working archaeologist in a number of areas around the world, including England, Portugal, just returned from Tunisia. Perhaps his most famous work is the area that he will discuss today, Cyprus, the ancient city of Kurion. We are pleased to have him with us today. I'd like to announce that there will be a talk back at 11 o'clock in room 120 of Smith Curtis. If you can stay following that, he will be showing a videotape of the excavation, some pictures that you will not see at this hour. At that time, so if you have that hour available, I will take the liberty also of inviting you to come to, if you can't make that hour, to a 2 o'clock class in the second floor of Old Main as you go up. Which room is yet to be determined? Will it be 304? 304 of Old Main. And if you can join us for lunch, he'll be happy to take your questions at 12 o'clock in the Conestoga room. So three opportunities. 11 o'clock today for a talkback session, lunch at 12, or a class at 2 o'clock. It is my pleasure to introduce to you a man who began life thinking he wanted to be a tap dancer. Grew up in a rough life, pretty much worked his way through his college experiences, now is supported by National Geographic Society, among others. One of the leading archaeologists probably in the world today, and a site that I trust you will find fascinating, every bit as important as the Pompeii discovery in the last century. We are happy to have Professor David Sorin.
Thank you very much, Dr. Peabody. And actually, one of my graduate advisors suggested that I continue that career in tap dancing. And, not go on in classical archaeology, but I've done it anyway. I'm going to be taking you on a voyage of the mind, I guess, to a site in the eastern Mediterranean called Kurion. It's on the island of Cyprus, and we've been excavating there since 1978. I'm working with the National Geographic Society primarily, but also in conjunction with the University of Arizona and the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Institute for Laboratory Science in Ventura, California. I hope I've mentioned all my sponsors because they frequently have spies planted in audiences in various places, so to make sure that they get their names mentioned. This is an illustrated lecture, a slide lecture, which I know will depress much of the radio audience, but nonetheless, we'll forge ahead, and I'll show you some of the discoveries that we're making. Having a small seismic disaster here, apparently, at the moment, but there we are. The island of Cyprus is located right here in the eastern Mediterranean, and as you can see, it's very near the southern coast of Turkey, the Syria-Palestinian coast, and not terribly far, within several hundred miles of Alexandria in Egypt. Cyprus was an ancient cultural crossroads. And as you'll see, it has produced some rather remarkable structures and very interesting art. We are working in the southwestern part of Cyprus in this area here known as Kurion, K-O-U-R-I-O-N in Greek, but to the Romans, and it was a Roman city as well, it was C-U-R-I-U-M. The people who settled Kurion spoke Greek, but in the first century B.C., they came under Roman control, so Latin was occasionally spoken there as well. And by the 4th century A.D., they were Christians, although Cyprus was one of the earliest Christian communities. St. Paul actually visited Kurion and found people involved in games naked in the stadium. We don't talk about that too much, but in any case, that occurred in the 1st century A.D. Now, we're going to be looking at two areas. One of them is the sanctuary of the god Apollo. Apollo was the patron divinity from at least the 4th century B.C. in this particular area. And this was simply a sanctuary. And next to that, there's the famous stadium. And next to that is the city of Kurion itself, a very important city with maybe 40, 50,000 people or more by Roman times. Now, the site itself, the whole area, is perched on the edge of a cliff, and you can see the cliffs here. If anyone violated the altar to Apollo, touched the altar of Apollo, they would be, according to the writer Strabo, thrown over the edge of the cliff to their death. This is what the sanctuary looked like about the time I started working there. It had been excavated by a number of people before I started working there, and one of the most interesting of these was a General Cesnola, a great treasure hunter who was interested in rivaling the discoveries going on at the same time at Troy and Mycenae being made by Heinrich Schliemann, a name familiar to many of you. Cesnola discovered the Kurion treasure, which is now much of it is now in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. And then the site was excavated largely by a man named George McFadden. McFadden had he did not have a degree in archaeology, but he had one of the principal requirements for being an archaeologist, and that is that he was a millionaire. So he began excavating in 1934. In 1953, before publishing the site, he, a gifted yachtsman, capsized his boat in the Episcopi Bay, very nearby, and drowned. His body washed ashore the next day. Another one of his colleagues, principally involved with field directing at the site, was J.F. Daniel of the University Museum in Philadelphia, University of Pennsylvania. And J.F. Daniel, shortly after working at the site for a while, was riding in a Jeep, bouncing up and down, felt ill, collapsed, and died. And I have to tell you that I haven't been feeling very well lately either. Now, I'll just go back for one. Oh dear! Can we reverse?
You got a button. Thanks.
We just go back. That's just great. McFadden excavated this site, which consisted of a temple, and here's the temple of the god Apollo. These buildings, subsidiary buildings here, were structures which were used for worshippers who would come to the site and bring offerings, sometimes the first fruits of their harvest, at other times clay figurines who would be placed around the altar in this area here and who would stand in for the worshipper. Now, there are a number of bath buildings that were built there, exercise grounds for the benefit of worshippers. But this whole huge area here was left unexcavated by McFadden, primarily because it was a large, flat area, and he was very interested in playing the game croquet. And he needed a large, flat area in which to stick his wickets. So that was this area here. I thought it was a very intriguing area, and after his death, in 1977, when I was awarded the site, this was one of the first areas I wanted to investigate. He believed that in ancient times it was a park, but I was very interested. I was very interested in two principal areas. One was the temple, which was not restored at all, and the other was this general area right in here. This is McFadden over here overseeing in the 1930s. his excavation area. And as you can see, when you look at these old photographs, these are large blocks that have tumbled down. And there was a great tradition, both in the literary sources and in the excavators' reports, journals, of earthquakes, seismic activity. And I'm very interested in ancient disasters of all sorts. So as a disaster groupie, I wanted to investigate this particular area and see what I could find out about ancient earthquakes. As I continued working, I was able to produce a plan of the site with our architects, which shows you the temple. And if you were a worshiper to this site, you could come in from one of two gates, walk down a principal street, and standing in this area, you could either go to the altar precinct, which in ancient times was quite sacred, and you couldn't touch it, under penalty of death, or continue straight to the temple, or go to what was traditionally thought to be this park area over in here, but in which we found, at just below the level of a wicket, a very a most extraordinary discovery, which I'll talk about in just a moment. Behind that temple, when we excavated, and this is the back of the temple right here, we made a very interesting discovery. When we moved the surface earth away, we found what amounted to the upper third of the back wall of the temple. It had fallen off, and it didn't just tumble or collapse. It had been sheared off and thrown. And we brought in a geophysicist and two seismic archaeology experts, one of them from Cincinnati Bible College, Reuben Bullard, one of the most distinguished people in his field. And these three individuals were able to determine that this was probably thrown off the back of the temple in a shear wave. In other words, the upper third of the temple fell off and the back wall was lying face down. And here we can see the architrave of the temple and some of the blocks of the upper wall. The rest of the temple would have remained and would have been removed by stone robbers in the years that followed this disaster. So you have this very odd phenomenon, which is that you have the lower part of a temple preserved and the upper part, and no middle. And for a while, that really disturbed people, seeming to be an impossibility. But that is what happened. The upper third sheared off, and then the lower part was left, and the intervening part was robbed out. As we continued to work, we were able to generate a reconstruction of what the temple would have looked like. And we found out that it was built probably in the time of the Emperor Nero, about 65 AD. With the help of the Athens Polytechnical Institute and Professor Stefanos Sinos, we were able to set up a quarry. And in this quarry and reconstruction area, we actually prepared blocks for this temple. It was our desire to rebuild it, for we were able, with the parts that we found, to restore it in this fashion, showing the pediment. We knew the slope of the top of the temple, the capitals. And the capital type comes from Syria, and there are a lot of parallels in Syria for this. It ultimately originated in Egypt as a type of squat Corinthian capital, and then develops in Syria, Palestine, and works its way to Cyprus in the first century AD. We were able to generate this kind of a reconstruction drawing, and after 4 years of work, we were able actually to dedicate this temple just this past summer. This much of it has actually been built up. And I can tell you that putting an ancient temple back up is not only very expensive, but very time-consuming, a terrific amount of work. And this is the first restored Roman temple in all of Cyprus. Up until this work, we didn't know what a Roman Cypriot temple looked like. Now we can say, can bring people up there and say, it was this high and it looked like that. Now, there's the temple as it's been reconstructed. Another monument which we have found, which has been quite unusual, in this so-called park area, turns out to be a monument unique in Mediterranean archaeology. It is a round building which has a walkway around it, a wall enclosing that walkway, a ramp which had its own entrance, separate accessway or entranceway, and in the center, which was hypaethral, or open to the sky, were radially displaced tree pits, pits for sacred trees. We think they may have been the date palm. And you know, in the Bible, there are many accounts of sacred trees and also of high places. This is a very controversial discovery, raised as it is on a terrace, with sacred trees radially displaced around it. There are no other monuments exactly like this thing, but we think there may have been sacred trees with maybe shallow root systems, such as date palms. The work here was done by Darris Burge from Berkeley, who is the world's leading authority on ancient sacred tree pits. They actually have authorities on subjects as esoteric as that, and we were very lucky to get her. So those were the things we were working on. And Discover Magazine, not too long ago, sent me out an artist, and we worked for some time and were able to do this reconstruction drawing, which gives you the whole idea of what the sanctuary may have looked like. There's the round building with its the date palms in it. And it gives you an idea of what the sanctuary may have looked like in the first century A.D. We can't guarantee the accuracy of every single square inch of this thing, but I think it's quite valuable for tourists and scholars to get an idea of this sanctuary. We have a book coming out with Arizona Press that will be out in a couple of months detailing the work here. But as I was studying all these buildings, and particularly the temple, I began to get interested in seismic archaeology, a field which I found didn't really exist. And we had to kind of create it using geophysicists, geologists, formation processes experts, experts from a wide variety of areas in order to give us a picture of what an ancient disaster does and ultimately to rebuild the city. And that's what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the time. On the 21st of July, 365 AD, there was a terrible disaster. We know this from a number of sources, the most important of which is Ammianus Marcellinus, who was an eyewitness. Ammianus tells us about this incredible disaster which affected a number of Mediterranean areas. He talks also about Alexandria in Egypt being struck by tidal waves, seismic sea waves, and that there were coastal areas where the waters receded, where animals, where fish, starfish, whatever, were stuck in the slime off the coast. People went out to gather them up. The waters came back in and killed thousands and thousands of people. Bodies were floating about in the water. Now, what could occur, what could cause something like this? There have been a number of theories proposed over the years. For many years, a popular theory was that the earthquake occurred somewhere along this coast, and there was abundant evidence of earthquake damage throughout Syria and Palestine. But a recent article, just several years old, done by a professor at Utah, has shown that this was an earthquake of 363 AD and not 365 AD at all. And of course, an earthquake inland like this wouldn't have caused tidal waves, or what we should more correctly call seismic sea waves, in other areas. A French team at the CNRS in Toulouse and at Nantes, a team which I'm now working with, proposed that this gigantic earthquake occurred off the coast of Crete. And they pointed out that there are, if we consider the science of plate tectonics, that there is a massive fault line, or series of fault areas, at the points where the plates, the floating plates of Europe, the European plate, and the African plate collide. This is an area of great seismic tension. So I'll shake my pointer to indicate that. I'm not really nervous up here. It's just a dramatic prop. But here you can see the fault line as it actually went along. And there's no real reason why it should occur off of Crete, but it should occur somewhere along this line of maximum seismic activity. I didn't know about this line, but from our site and from a site called Paphos nearby, we were able to show that in earthquake waves, pulses from the earthquake, material, walls and things were being thrown directionally. Generally, walls were being thrown to the north and east, and on the western coast of the island, walls were being thrown to the north and west. We drew a line suggesting that somewhere around this point was where the gigantic disaster occurred, and I'll show you some more evidence for that in just a few moments. But the temple was falling to the north and east, and we think it was within about 25 or 30 miles of Cyprus. So evidence of a mega disaster, of a gigantic earthquake occurring somewhere in this general region, and we think that it is the earthquake that occurred on the 21st of July, 365 AD. If that is true, it is the first time that that epicenter will have ever been pinpointed after many hundreds of years now of controversy, but we think we're right about this. One of the bits of evidence that I used to develop this theory about this mega disaster of 365 had been discovered by a man named J.F. Daniel. I've spoken about him already. He was working at the city site of Kurion, just down the road, about 2 miles from the sanctuary I've just been showing you. And at the University of Pennsylvania Museum, I found in my archival work these photographs of skeletons, which were described as Romeo and Juliet by the excavators, because they were supposed to be two skeletons, a man and a woman, embracing in death. And the date of this was given at about 325 AD, supposedly the date of the earthquake that destroyed the site. I was able, through the field notes, to gather the coins and objects that were found with these skeletons, because the numbers still existed. But I began to find that the coins didn't date to the 320s at all. They dated to the 350s and 360s. Right about the time of the July 21st, 365 AD mega disaster. So I began to feel I was on the right track. I was also disturbed by the fact that these bodies aren't embracing at all. If you look carefully, you'll see a skull. Here's an arm, a pelvis, and a leg. There's a big storage jar. Here's a bronze pitcher, bronze pouring vessel. And there's nothing for this no one for this figure to embrace. There are simply two legs up here of another figure, and unfortunately they seem to have excavated away the rest of that individual. They've just misinterpreted what they were finding. But in any case, here were two earthquake victims or potential earthquake victims and their objects and a good number of coins dating to the 360s. The trouble was, in the field diary, there was only a sketch or a rough outline of what the trench looked like, but no location. So we had no idea over a 6-square-mile area where this trench had been dug in 1934, which was very depressing. And it took me about a year and a half to find out where this trench was actually dug. And it happened quite by accident. I was simply reading a book about inscriptions. I knew in the back of my mind that something called Trench 3 was this magic trench that had the skeletons in it. In the back of this inscription book, there were a whole series of plans and drawings about the site, and one of them attracted my attention. I think this will focus just a little bit. I hope this will focus up. There was a trench right in, there we go. See this little thing right there with the funny little flags on it? Little dotted outline, and there's a Roman numeral 3 right there. The writer of this book was using an old friend of his plan. And it happened to have the exact shape of the sounding in the field diary that I had and the little number 3. So we went out to the site right away, tested to see if this was the very trench where the bodies were found, and we began to find small traces of human bones, just little bits of toe and finger, things like this, but they began to show up, and we got very excited at that point. So this was going to be the focal area of our investigation. By now, I was writing theoretical articles and getting a lot of criticism in the media and especially by my colleagues for trying to pinpoint this particular earthquake to the island of Cyprus. I gave an international symposium lecture in Nicosia in 1980 and was almost laughed off the stage. It didn't help that I tripped and fell flat on my face getting onto the stage. But no one really bought this theory, and the antiquities director, Dr. Kariorgas, invited me in 1983 to come in the summer of 84 and test my theories. It was a put up or shut up, and I decided to reopen this trench at the city of Kurion, a site that had not really been investigated except for this one trench in 1934. And so that was the start of our new work. we began right away to find coins of a gentleman who is now my favorite Roman emperor, a man named Valens, who ruled from 364 to 378. But he tended early in his reign to issue a particular kind of coin in 364 and 365, the time of the earthquake. This coin is known as the split Valens type, and it's my favorite Roman coin. It has the letters of the emperor's name. You can read V-A-L-E, and then you would see N. And on the other side of his head is the S of Valens' name. So you get V-A-L-E-N, then you get S. So it's called a split Valens, and then he's Praefectus Augustus. And here's his portrait. But in his later coins, and in a few coins from this early period too, the S appears on the other side of his head. But we are getting a large number of split Valens coins, suggesting that we are still very early in his reign. And, of course, 365 A.D. is the time of the great quake. So if we're getting a lot of coins of 364, early 365, this is very, very helpful to the earthquake theory. So the Valens coins are extremely important to us. We began to widen the old trench. The old trench was just right there. We began to widen it. And everywhere we dug, to my great surprise, we found that no one had built over it. No one had touched this site for over 1,600 years. And so we were looking at a site destroyed by earthquake, and we were beginning to realize everything was still there, just as it had been at that very moment in time. Life stopped at Kurion on the 21st of July. And here we were, the rescue party. All these centuries later, what would we find? The first thing we began to find in this same room that we opened up was a coin hoard with many of these Valens coins. Then we found someone's jewelry collection. Here, a series of rings. This one has a serpent head, and another was a key ring for opening boxes and things. Just a nice little bronze or copper alloy key ring. And then we began to find things like bronze lamps, oil lamps. And this one was an heirloom or something that had been given to them. It dated to the 1st century A.D., but was still being used in the 4th century A.D. Wherever we find metals at our site, the preservation is so good that it sets up a chemical condition whereby perishable materials are also preserved. So linen, wood, even flax of various kinds would be preserved. And these are the wicks that were burning inside that lamp 1,600 years ago. They were of a material which Pliny, the ancient writer, called oakum, low grade of flax. The original trench was over in this area. This will focus just a little bit. We found one of the walls that Daniel had uncovered, and we moved over the wall, and there we got a real shocker because we found immediately a feeding trough for an animal which had been more in the center of the room, but through the force of the earthquake had been picked up and thrown into this particular wall. This was very unfortunate for an animal that happened to be attached to it, for right there is the skeleton of a mule which had been chained with an iron chain to this feeding trough and went right along with it and was still chained when we found it. And on the back of that animal right there was the body of a 13-year-old girl. In this same room were all sorts of other objects, and this was a stable. This was a stable in 365 A.D. So if you'd like to see what a stable looked like in 365 A.D., I'm going to show you some of the things right now and the way we reconstruct these areas. A marble table was found in the room, and marble tabletops like this are very useful because they're found in pieces, and the way in which it was thrown and shattered gives us great information about the intensity of the quake. We use for measuring earthquakes something called the Mercalli scale. The Mercalli scale is a non-seismic instrument way of measuring earthquakes. So zero is no damage at all. 12 is something like the Last Judgment. So we had we had roughly a 9 or a 10, according to the geologist's estimate, and that is a tremendous earthquake, larger than the quake that hit Mexico City not too long ago. And here is a marble tabletop that was in the stable. And here is the marble tabletop as we find it, little bits. And sitting on the marble tabletop was most likely this lampstand, a bronze lampstand, which had its lamp still on top of it when we excavated it. This, too, was an heirloom from perhaps the 2nd century B.C. And when we get up to the top of it, you can see the detail in this. These are little dolphin heads. The antiquities director of Cyprus insists that these are duck heads. And so when I give this lecture in Cyprus, these are duck heads. But in the continental United States, at least, they are definitely dolphin heads. Raging, absolutely raging argument. Here you get an idea of the trough. And one of the things we began to discover was that there were multiple pulses. The first pulse seems to have shaken down a number of walls. The ceilings began to fall in. And then but people were still alive and moving through the debris. And then about 3 to 5 seconds later, there seems to have been a second pulse. And this was the sort of thing that was just disastrous, the kind of thing that seems to have knocked over the temple. The shear wave, or secondary wave, as it might be called, moving in a number of directions, as well as tending to throw things directionally. Some walls collapsed simply. Others were thrown to the north and east at our site. Here, and this will focus just a bit, you can see the skeleton of the mule. I think you can read that fairly clearly. There's the legs. Here are the teeth and even the rings. There's one of them there. There were two, one bronze and one iron, for the bridle of the horse were still intact, hadn't been touched. And the animal was tethered right here. There's a bit of the iron chain. It had collapsed, but we could still find traces of it. The fittings for the mule were found underneath it, and the bits of the iron chain were able to be reconstructed, so we got an idea of how the animal was tethered at that time. The child on the back of the animal looked like this when we found her. Her skull was crushed. She had looked in the direction of the earthquake, put her hands over her head, sank to her knees, struggling, crawling through the rubble for a while, but just finally burrowing her face down in the direction that the quake was coming from, to the southwest. And in sieving her skull, we found this delicate bone hairpin, which had probably held in place a chignon hairstyle typical of the 4th century A.D. This is all that's left of the child, which we called Camellia. Since this photo was taken, which appeared, I think, in Discover magazine, we've managed to painstakingly get some of her skull together. One of the problems was that she was just so crushed by these falling blocks, some of them weighing dozens of pounds, hitting her in the face, just getting her from all sides. And we know also that after she died, there were spaces left in the rubble, and rodents, probably rats, came down in the spaces to feed off of any tender flesh that could be found. One rat was probably trapped in an aftershock because we find one rodent right on the child's body as well. We begin, when we find information like this, to get artists working. Bill Bond, who works for National Geographic, and a number of other artists were working with me, putting this information together, trying to achieve a reconstruction drawing so you could experience what it was like in the last phases of this young lady's life. So this is the kind of preliminary sketch we begin to do. But by the time we put all the information together, it starts to look like this, and you can see the child and the mule. And here was a glass vessel that had a hoard of coins in it, the doorways, the kind of construction, the marble table, the lampstand, the feeding trough, the iron chain. And you put that all together, and you can get a pretty good idea what a stable was like. That was with the first pulse, and this is the last moments of mule, trough, table, and the child in her final agonal position, final trauma. We work a lot with doctors also in doing these reconstruction drawings and studying ancient trauma. We also find a whole host of objects of all sorts that were in use it would be as if you're in your home and your home collapses and you have a good idea of some objects that are family heirlooms, other objects that happen to be in use at your particular time. And we get a whole catalog of these things. I just show you one. Here's a popular kind of oil lamp. You put the wicks here. You'd put olive oil inside. And this is on the 21st of July what people happen to be using in 365 AD for reasonably priced oil lamps. Then we find whole rooms full of pottery. This is really depressing because you have tens of thousands of sherds, and each piece has to be mapped, and you have to try and figure out which pieces go with which pots. We have seven people who do nothing but this. And they come from all over the world, really. We have five different countries working on the project, but a staff of seven conservators. And they're always extremely depressed when we are nearing the end of our rubble clearing, because they know when the stones come off that they're apt to find rooms that look like this, and they're going to be getting many sleepless nights. And we usually wait till about the last 3 or 4 days of the dig before we find rooms like this to make them extremely upset. So I try to, right around the last 3 or 4 days of the excavation, we have a little motto, which is take a conservator to dinner. You take them out, buy them food, give them lots of sometimes wine, anything that will help them get through these last few painful days. Because their job is to take these masses of sherds, put them all together. And we call this part of our site Pots in Bondage. We put the we tie them up, glue them all together, and build them up. And then when we're all done with that, we get things that look like this, dozens and dozens and dozens of these things. And these are telling us about the trade connections of these ancient people. This particular amphora, for example, came from Gaza and shows us Syro-Palestinian trade connections. There are many, many more. Another thing we do, and these are some of the conservators here. You can see how tired they look. And they will take these objects and bring them back to the very room in which they were found. And then you can take photographs of them with all the objects in situ. This is 1/3 of the objects that was found in just this room. And remember, we have 24 rooms that we have excavated so far. Most of them have lots of pots. I have a fairly high turnover also in conservators with my project. When they get older and get fine-paying jobs, they just simply write me letters. And I usually don't see them again on the project. When you begin excavating, though, you get rooms that look like this. This is what the earthquake rubble tends to look like. And as you can see, it seals the rooms very nicely. This area was excavated in 84. Here we are in 1985. We take the topsoil off, and it's just rainwash. That's all it is. There's no overbuilding at all. And you come right down on this, and once you take this stuff off, you call the conservators, because you're going to have lots and lots of stuff. It starts looking like this in the next phase. And here we have a large room, a very large room, in the same house that we've been uncovering. There's the earlier areas of excavation. In 85, we move over here. And here, if you look closely, you'll see smashed roof tiles. We have people who come and count roof tiles. They do nothing but count how many corners. And, of course, a roof tile has four corners. So they take all the corners that they count, and they divide by four. And that tells us exactly how many roof tiles were on the roof on the last day of the house. Then they study the mortars, and that gives us the slope of the roof, the pitch of the pediment as well. A column was in the center of the room. In another area, an alabaster table showed up. And then you do sectional drawings, which show how this all fit together, that the roof slid in and collapsed with the first pulse, that the walls crashed down in this dynamic second pulse that occurred. In this room, we're finding all sorts of objects. Here, for example, a beautiful bronze lamp of the first century AD, which was a hanging lamp with chains, still maintains its original form. Very rare to find anything preserved like that. And this is my wife's drawing of what this thing looked like. We even found evidence that it was so valued in antiquity that it had ancient repairs, new links added to it in ancient times to keep it going. You find things like proportional dividers, where an architect or an artist could take something that was one size and double its size, or something one size and make it half of its size. But these are artists' proportional dividers found in a pit of sand at the back of a large room. We can reconstruct these rooms, and this is something of what the room looked like. There's the bronze hanging lamp, our rough sketches, and then the artists come along from National Geographic or from our project, and they show you that this room, which was once a large and elegant room, had fallen onto hard times. Someone had been recently having a meal. Here's a cup and a plate for the meal, and someone has been working, grinding over here, a little basin, a little hatchet, and some grinding stones over here. This had once been a column base, but it's turned upside down and used as a grinding area. Someone else, or maybe the same person, had a pitchfork, various grinding stones, pouring vessels. There's the proportional divider. It's all ready for someone to walk through that door and begin work. And then we began to find more bodies, not just the bodies found in 1934, but many more bodies as well. This unfortunate individual, whom we named Bruce, actually we called him Bruce the Loose because of the way in which he was put together, or not put together, I should say. He had subscribed to that tried and true axiom that you should, during times of earthquake, take refuge in a doorway. This did not work for him. The doorway collapsed on his head, and it sent his teeth into the air. His torso, his upper torso, was trapped between the falling lintel blocks of the doorway and the sides of the doorway, the massive blocks. His lower torso was left exposed and has disappeared. We think it may have been ripped off by wild animals, perhaps dogs, looking for food after this disaster, but it is nowhere to be found. So we can safely say that this man had a very rough day, with a crushed skull, a pinned torso, upper torso, and no lower torso whatsoever. And he was found in one of the rooms of this house. Here's all that's left of this poor individual as Walter Berkby, our forensic anthropologist. He's a specialist in modern murders. He goes out when bodies are found in the woods, this man goes out and studies them, and he does the same thing for 1,600-year-old bodies and recreates the trauma of the death. This man, as if this all wasn't bad enough, this man also suffered severely from osteoarthritis. And here are his remains, as best we could pull them out. This block, and then his teeth were just in all directions up above. So the site began to pull together. We began to get a picture of a house. This will focus just a bit. A house where you could walk into a courtyard here, move through into a stable. In the back of it was a large room, originally a reception room. We began to find traces that the house had already been destroyed in an earlier earthquake, probably not long before, and the standard of living was fairly low. But you could walk into the house. If you turned right, you went up a series of steps and went into a kitchen right here, a rooftop cistern there, the stable over here, the large reception room, later a grinding room, big storerooms for pottery over in here, and the courtyard. The gentleman was killed in the doorway right in this area here, but a big courtyard area with lots of grinding going on. That was the house, and this is the way it began to look at the beginning of 1986, and we continued to excavate. The rooftop cistern proved to be quite interesting, not only from the point of view of reconstructing an ancient cistern, but at some point, a woman had been bending over to fetch water, presumably from it, and a necklace she was wearing fell and got lodged in the silt at the bottom of the cistern. She was never able to retrieve it, fortunately for us, and so this is the necklace that she dropped, and it gave us an idea of what was being worn at the time. This is coral, amber, here's amber, and a material called jet, black stone, which came from Western Turkey, from Western Asia Minor. And then we found a complete kitchen, almost ready for operation. The mud brick oven, which was in the center of it, had left enough pieces so that we could reconstruct its curvature, and its dimensions. And then these are all the things you would have in a kitchen in 365 AD, a storage jar, some plates for eating, cooking pots of all sorts, other vessels, amphorae, pouring vessels, all of this, even things like, it was very much like this, looked very much like a modern Cypriot oven today, and quite a few traces of wheat, probably for ancient bread. And vessels like this in bronze showing up. Even fish hooks and evidence of ancient Mediterranean fish showing up in this same actual room. So here was the kitchen. As you went into the house, right in there was the kitchen. And there's that little oven that we were talking about. And there's the cistern. There's the stable. As we continued working then, we were able to, by 1986, by the end of the summer, excavate most of the house. But when you do this and you're plotting room after room after room, it's a great challenge to get your computer mappers, your computer specialists in, and get every object and plot it and see exactly what it looked like to attempt to reconstruct what life in this house was really like at this last moment in time. So we start with overviews of the site like this, and then we do a computer projection which shows us, using the evidence from the various experts, what these rooms were like, the heights of the rooms, the type of columns that might be used, the paving, the staircases, the cisterns, the kitchens, and all the objects that we find. So all of that's laid out on the computer, and then we call formation processes experts in. These are people who study these ancient disasters in great detail, and we are able to get an artist to produce something like this to show you what the house was like. And then the artist studies the colors that we're finding, the range of colors, the possibilities for the roof, and he refines his drawing into something like this, and it begins to give us more of a picture. We can imagine going into this house, going around the peristyle, taking refuge from the earthquake in this area here. Since this drawing now, we know that there were larger blocks that are shown. There's the lintel block right there. He got his head crushed here. Inside the stable here is where the child died. There's the big room, the big pottery magazines right in here, the staircase to the rooftop cistern, the kitchen, all of these things. And then once having put that together, taking all the objects that we plot, we can do this and give you a picture of what life was like at that final moment in time. At 5:30 in the morning on the 21st of July, 365 AD, this is what things looked like. Now, that would have been a very successful couple of years, but we began excavating in this area. And there we got a surprise that we really hadn't bargained for. We already had evidence of two bodies here, another body there, another body here, the mule, a rodent right there. There's even a part of a cat right in here. Well, that was the body count up until the last few days of 1986. And right in this area here, we found evidence for more bodies. A whole wall had collapsed, leaving painted architectural decoration. This block weighs about 500 pounds. It's part of a pediment. That had fallen in on top of someone's bedroom, and they hadn't been able to get out. And as we dug down, this is what we found, a whole family that was huddling together for protection from this terrible disaster. A woman with very beautiful teeth. They didn't have sugar in those days or forks. You know, you didn't use knives very much, so they tore and chewed their food a lot. And they didn't have all this sugar to rot their teeth. Beautiful teeth. Here she was with her husband. There's a block on top of her head that hit her head. Her husband with a crushed skull still trying to protect her. He has his arm around her right there. His pelvis and thorax have been crushed, but his leg is over her leg to protect her in the final moments. And in her arms, a child, 1.5 years old. The woman is about 25. The man is 25 or older. There's the head of the child. Can you see it? The top of the skull. There's the jaw, the mouth of the child. And right here, the child is holding on to the elbow of the mother, and the head of the child is pressed against the mother's mouth. The child may have lived for some time, for it wasn't crushed, but again, rodents have come down, fed on the child's flesh, and stretched the flesh, scattered it around this area. As we get up closer to it, you can see the beautiful preservation of this particular skeleton, series of skeletons, and you can see that the woman died of a broken neck. There's a very clear example. Just under this block, when we removed it, was a bone hairpin, and on the finger of the male, of the husband, was a ring. It was right here. Here, the body of the child, the red shows the child, and where the rat or the rodents have scattered the child's flesh. But on the ring of the finger of the man was this ring with the first two letters of Jesus' last name, the Kairo for Christos, and showing us that this was probably a Christian family and a Christian community by this time. I understand that this picture appeared in your local papers of the bodies, and I would get letters from children from all over the world, especially from Christian communities, from churches, saying that this to them was a message of love sent down through the centuries. It certainly was a moving, very moving thing to find that in their last moments, people protecting each other and trying to help each other at the very last. When the site was eventually rebuilt, it was as a Christian city under the protection of Christ, and the symbol of the new city was this mosaic, Catesis, a figure who is a personification of rebuilding. And in the same house, we are reminded that the houses are now under the protection of Christ. Well, that's a little bit of a look at what life was like back on the 21st of July on 365 AD, and I certainly hope that you'll find it as fascinating as I did. Thank you very much.
Today, University Forum has presented David Sorin, Professor of Classical Archaeology at the University of Arizona. He spoke on Buried Alive, an Ancient Catastrophe in Cyprus. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.